Chapter 7. Hand to hand.
Chris.
Vin Tanner shouted a split second before the helmsman shoved him forcefully behind some crates. Chris did not know what was going on until he saw the bullet that would have torn a hole through his chest, slam into the wooden beam of a nearby hitching post. The disorientation resulting from his hard impact on the ground lasted only a split second before his mind was alert and ready to act.
Take cover.
Chris's voice rose over the sound of exploding gunfire. Not that he needed to give that warning because everyone was diving for cover as soon as they saw Top Hat Bob and his comrades draw. Buck, who was nearest to Mary and Nathan, grabbed the protocol officer's arm and ushered her toward the water trough near the hitching post. Bullets chased them with every step until they were forced into a skid across the hard ground to reach it. Streams of water escaped the bullet-riddled trough, creating an expanding puddle across the ground. Buck knew they could not remain hidden behind it for more than a few seconds because the constant barrage would turn the wood into kindling.
"We have to move!"
Buck shouted over the roar of gunfire. Nathan checked his gun, displaying a hint of apprehension at actually using it on someone alive, not a holodeck simulation. However, Buck was confident Nathan's crisis of conscience would only be temporary. Meanwhile, Mary faced an entirely different challenge, finding it exceedingly cumbersome to move in her restrictive clothes. The corset wrapped around her waist made it hard for her to remain prone, and he could see her straining against the pressure of the garment digging into her spine.
"Watch out!"
Nathan cried as a projectile ripped an exit point through the space near him, spraying them with splinters. Buck rolled onto his knees to get a better view of where they were and where they could reach shelter without being cut to ribbons. The captain was hiding behind some crates that were large enough to offer them the same protection, if only they could make it there.
"Chris!"
The captain looked over his shoulder immediately, hearing his voice through the gunfire. Then, overcoming his inexperience with a real Winchester after their earlier confrontation with Bob and his men, was making up for lost time. The helmsman aimed the sawn-off rifle at the thickest part of the enemy contingent and fired with surprising accuracy. Several of Bob's men had retreated to avoid being gunned down. Chris glanced in Buck's direction and saw the first officer's predicament. Not just his but also that of Mary and Nathan's. He winced slightly at her groveling in the dirt, trying to avoid the hail of bullets that would eventually penetrate the water trough to hit one of them. Chris recounted again what Ezra told him about using the weapon of choice for an old West gunslinger and cocked the gun accordingly in readiness to fire. His eyes met Buck's, and then Chris responded with a slight nod. Buck turned back to Mary and Nathan and saw the close shaves coming too frequently for his liking. If they did not move soon, one of them would get shot. The water trough was becoming more and more pitted. The odds were good that one of those bullets would eventually find a victim.
"When I give the word,"
Buck said as loud as he could without giving away their intentions to the enemy.
"Run to the captain."
Mary nodded wildly, relieved at the order. She looked across the space at Chris, who did the same. Their eyes locked as he silently reassured her that everything would be all right once she came to him. Mary believed him. However, the moment could not last, and Chris turned away, paving the way to make their advance toward the crates. The barricade was formidable enough to protect them from Top Hat Bob and his companions once Buck, Mary, and Nathan were behind its confines. Chris sought Bob, who was just as entrenched in his hiding place as Chris and Vin. The captain could see the calculation in the villain's one good eye when Bob noticed the exchange between Mary and him a second ago. Chris cursed under his breath, realizing Bob was not simply attempting to keep the others penned in but was now concentrating his fire on the beautiful woman who obviously held his heart. A wicked smile stretched across Bob's face as he fired a bullet that passed a hair's breadth away from Mary's face.
"Son of a bitch, he's trying to shoot Mary."
This had gone far enough. This bastard wanted a showdown. Then that's precisely what Chris would give him. Chris stood up straight, exposing himself to fire, with his gun held up in a request for parley.
"Captain!"
Vin barked.
"Chris, what the hell are you doing?"
Chris did not know for sure and wondered if his rage was getting the better of him. But Chris didn't care. Perhaps this place made him want to settle this entire feud in the most primitive way it could be resolved. The way they had done it since the beginning of human history. Sometimes, the only way to end a fight was to do it the old-fashioned way, with bare knuckles, until the enemy no longer stood up.
"Bob!
Hold your fire!"
Top Hat Bob ordered his men, hearing his nemesis call him out.
"Chris!"
Mary's voice called after him.
"What are you doing?"
Chris ignored her. He ignored Buck's demand for him to get back to safety or Vin's warning that he would get himself killed. This had to stop before this bloody shootout got his crew killed. If it was Q's intention to have them perform like puppets, then Chris would rob him of every ounce of pleasure the entity strived to take from forcing them to take part in this play. The shooting slowed and then stopped altogether. No one spoke as the air went deadly silent.
What in the hell is he doing?
Ezra Standish demanded, almost prepared to go out there and find out. When the firing started, Ezra got Josiah and Julia to safety, finding an alley between two buildings. The gambler kept Bob's cohorts from reaching them, but he was torn between leaving Julia and Josiah unprotected and going to help the captain. The counselor could defend himself but lacked the ruthless savagery of his opponents.
I don't know.
Josiah shook his head, dumbfounded as he saw the captain make his way out in the open, challenging Bob to approach. The man with the appellation of Top Hat Bob seemed reluctant at first, staring suspiciously at Chris and the rest of them to decide if this was a trick.
However, I assume Chris knows what he is doing.
Never assume a captain knows what they are doing. The position comes with an assumption of godhood that leads them to play the most foolish games with their lives.
The captain would not place his life in danger unless he knew he could get out of it.
Julia came to Chris's defense. She had tremendous faith in Chris's ability to extract himself and his ship from danger, as he had done so frequently before this. The captain did very little without considering the consequences to himself and his crew. Everything Julia Pemberton knew about Chris Larrabee told her his sudden desire to face Top Hat Bob in the open was part of a plan to extract them from their present crisis.
Spoken like an engineer.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
Ezra knew he was being a little harsh. Still, the entire situation, not just their abduction to this make-believe world but everything that transpired since the Akron invasion of the Maverick had eroded any ability to control his temper.
I have no time to explain it to you. Your expertise is in engineering. Mine is security, and at the moment, we need security, not amateurs with wishful thinking.
Wishful thinking?
Julia bit back angrily. Josiah, who until now kept silent, noticed the unresolved tension reaching climax. Their affection was apparent, and thus their passion, when incited, was equally fiery. He knew this confrontation was a long time coming, and the counselor in him welcomed it, but this was not the time for such displays. Not when caught in a life-or-death situation where they needed to be thinking clearly.
Officers.
Josiah spoke up before this argument turned from a brush fire to a raging inferno.
This is not the time.
Julia broke her gaze first and turned away, but Ezra stared just a little longer, and the hurt in his eyes was evident, even for someone accustomed to letting no one in on his private emotions. Secretly, Josiah hoped they resolved their differences soon. Obviously, they still cared deeply for one another, even if their present behavior might say otherwise. Ezra returned his attention to the captain, grateful Josiah was present to remind him of his duty and feeling somewhat embarrassed at having to be reminded at all. Julia decided the best course of action was to stay as far away from Ezra as possible for the duration of this mission. Secretly, she ached that their relationship had deteriorated so badly they couldn't even remain civil to one another. It was unprofessional and embarrassing, especially when the entire senior staff could see what was happening. As it was, Julia, still stung from the dressing down the captain was forced to give them earlier. Instead of remaining where she was, Julia advanced further up the alleyway, searching for a route to help them escape their fight with Top Hat Bob and his men before the captain faced the villain on his own. Really, Julia knew she was looking for something to occupy her mind because it was becoming increasingly difficult to not dwell on her crumbling love affair with Ezra Standish. She knew she loved him, and he loved her. Why was it so difficult for her to accept his apology and move on? She wanted things to go back to the way they were before the Akrons hijacked her body and seduced Ezra. The passageway was so narrow there was barely space enough for one person to walk in single file, so she was reasonably unconcerned when she continued through the gap between the two buildings. The street at the end of the alley beckoned her forward. She was almost halfway through when she realized there was a doorway leading to the building on the left. She edged closer to it to see where it led, assuming it was a back door entrance. Julia paused a few feet from it, glancing over her shoulder to see what Josiah and Ezra were doing. She was breaking Captain's orders by going off on her own when Chris made it clear he wanted everyone together. Realizing the prudence of his words, she turned around and prepared to retreat when suddenly something moved in the long shadows, using the poor lighting to hide. The palm that covered her mouth and yanked her back into the shadows moved with such speed that Julia barely had time to process the attack until it was too late. Someone's moist, warm breath touched her ear, stroking her primitive fears with icy terror. Opening her mouth to scream, the hand clamped over her face and killed any sound she tried to utter. Still, Julia was not helpless. She slammed an elbow into the soft flesh of what could have been a stomach. There was a soft groan and a quick growl of outrage. Julia felt fingers digging into her hair with just as much fury before the wall rushed up at her with blinding speed. The impact of her skull against the wall brought with it cool darkness, and she knew no more. Chris Larrabee stood before Top Hat Bob and wondered what he was thinking. When he saw Mary being targeted explicitly by Bob, he didn't care if this was an illusion created by Q. Top Hat Bob had crossed the line. The man tried to kill the woman he loved, and under no circumstances would Chris Larrabee or the captain of the Maverick take that lying down. If Bob wanted him so badly, perhaps it was time to give the man the showdown Bob wanted, but under Chris's terms. Men like Bob were easy to manipulate once Chris stopped thinking like a man trapped in a fantasy world and remembered he was a starship captain with a mean streak when pissed off. When he had stepped out into the open, Chris knew he had captured Bob's attention. The firing stopped as the villain tried to understand what he was attempting to do. When it was quiet, and Chris was sure Bob could hear him, he called out again. Bob, you want a piece of me?
You got it coming!
Bob barked, stepping out from his hiding place to face Chris. I sure do. Chris nodded in agreement, not about to deny any of the sins Bob claimed he committed. Chris had to confess his guilt for the man to play his game. The question is, are you man enough to come get you some? Bob's eyes flared in outrage at the suggestion.
I'm more man than you'll ever be.
All right then, Chris unbuckled his gun belt slowly and paused before reaching the final notch that would send their weapons to the ground. What say we prove it?
You must think I'm a fool.
Bob appeared less confident than he had been a moment ago. However, he found himself suddenly in an intractable situation. If he were to deny Chris's challenge, he would look like a coward to the men he rode with. Weakness was something Top Hat Bob could not afford to show. In the West, it was pack rules. If he could not assert his dominance over his men, then one of them would try to run the show, presumably after they put a bullet in his back.
If you don't drop your guns and fight me fair and square, I'll know you're a coward.
Bob's eyes narrowed, and he surveyed the faces of his gang. They were staring at him, wondering what he was going to do. He could see the accusation slowly surfacing in their eyes with every second he took to answer Larrabee. He either fought Larrabee or lost their respect, and losing their respect was as good as being dead.
I'll show you who's a coward when you're begging me to save your yellow-bellied skin.
Bob growled and unhooked his gun belt. Chris looked over his shoulder and saw the terrified expression on Mary's face, her silent plea for him not to do this. Chris offered her a slight smile, assuring her he would be all right. Buck and Ezra wore the same look of worry and disapproval. Josiah's expression of concern mirrored Ben's, but the two men shared the same thought. They knew Chris wouldn't have entered this duel unless he knew he could win. Alex had made her way next to Mary to calm the protocol officer, but she flashed Chris a glance of concern at the same time. Nathan's disapproval of any kind of combat was evident by the distaste in his eyes, and JD seemed caught between concern and fascination. Chris wondered where Julia was.
Well, are we gonna do this, or are you just talk, Larrabee?
Top Hat Bob sneered and dragged Chris's attention back to him. Chris gazed at the man long and hard, pushing the images of his crew and Mary to the background as he prepared to fight. He remained where he was, making no initial move toward Bob. The weight made his opponent nervous because Bob couldn't decide if Chris was holding position because he was afraid or merely cautious. In either case, Chris showed nothing that could help Bob as the villain studied him. His previous experiences in hand-to-hand combat taught Chris one thing: always let the enemy strike first. It was a concept Bob obviously did not know of because, just as the thought crossed Chris's mind, the large man rushed at him. Chris's lack of action prompted Bob to attack first. The man circled him like a wolf preparing the death lunge. While Bob's combat technique was fraught with posturing and primitive displays of aggression, Chris was content to watch him move, concentrating on his muscle and body language while readying his own offensive when the fight really began. Bob threw a plump fist in Chris's direction, which the captain dodged easily. He was careful to keep a gap between them to ensure Bob would have to lunge to reach him. After the blow whooshed past him, Chris slammed a focused strike into Bob's side.
landing above the man's kidneys as Chris intended. Bob uttered a cry of pain. The villain howled, enraged at the knowledge the first punch to connect belonged to his nemesis. Worse yet, he had cried out, revealing Chris had hurt him. Anger drove his next strike, and when Bob swung again, it was wild, with the big man forgetting to protect himself. Chris did not let the opportunity go to waste. He dropped to one knee and struck Bob square in the stomach before the man had time to brace himself against the blow. He felt his palm sink into the fat belly and forced the wind from his opponent's lungs as Bob reeled backward. Not wasting any time, Chris stood upright again and took the offensive as Bob attempted to recover. While the outlaw was larger and possibly stronger, Bob was not a skilled fighter and was probably more accustomed to using a gun to kill his victims rather than his fists. That advantage was all someone like Chris, who had the skill but not the brute strength needed to win. Pummeling Bob in a succession of swift blows, Chris's punches struck the man's ribs and throat before delivering a final roundhouse swing across Bob's jaw. Bob staggered again, coughing loudly as his windpipe sustained a disabling injury, and tried desperately to recoup. He managed adequately but knew he had to get his hands on Chris if he was to have any chance of winning. Anger and hatred sent him running forward again, intending to tackle Chris in a body slam. Chris held his ground, watching him cross the gap, and braced himself for impact.
"Chris!"
Mary cried out. Ignoring Mary's voice, Chris leapt out of the way just as Bob was about to make contact. The villain ran straight into the wall. The loud crack as his skull met stone would have knocked an ordinary man unconscious. Unfortunately, Bob, running high on adrenaline and anger, was far from done. Chris did not have the patience for a prolonged battle and decided it was time to finish this. Taking advantage of Bob's brief stupor, Chris came up from behind him and slammed his foot into the bend of the man's knee, dropping him immediately. As Bob struggled to turn around, another bald fist struck him, followed by two palms that slammed into each side of his head. Another strike connected with the underside of his jaw, snapping his head back savagely, and in the daze of these deadly strikes, Bob crumpled to the ground in a heap. Chris stepped back, seeing no reason to continue. Bob was down, and they all knew it. Not just the crew of the Maverick but the men who rode with him. The captain didn't doubt they now viewed their leader with less reverence than earlier. The man was struggling to get to his feet, and the crimson stains on the ground showed Chris had hurt him badly. "I think we're done." Chris stood back and eyed Bob's men. None of them made a move toward him. When he turned back to his staff, Chris didn't expect anyone to stop him. He was right. This was as far as Top Hat Bob's revenge was going. It was over. Chapter 8. Death. The only description Billy Travis could make about the place he was presently occupying with his newfound friend Quinn was by the euphemistic term employed by scientists who made use of the technology. Anthropologists called the device a duck blind. Previously, Billy had been on expeditions with his mother and seen how the duck blind worked. Anthropologists studying primitive cultures use duck blinds to avoid contaminating primitive cultures with their presence. Using light refraction technology, the scientists could conduct their studies in a self-contained environment, completely invisible to the outside world. At the moment, he was in a duck blind with Quinn. Billy could see everything taking place and the bubble moved when they wished it to, so he could observe several people all at once. It was exciting to see the captain, Vin, and security chief Standish battling it out with the villain Top Hat Bob, but was slightly disturbed by the dead woman Nathan found on the street. He confessed he didn't like Mr. Poplar at all and was glad Josiah made him small when the two men encountered each other. When Mr. Wicks tried to hurt his ma, Billy felt afraid for her, but then Quinn assured him there was nothing to worry about. After all, wasn't she always getting into trouble in the real Magnificent Seven program? Billy knew it was only an excuse so the captain could rescue her. In fact, it appeared to Billy the only reason to have women in the program at all was so the man could save them. Whenever his mother or Chief Engineer Pemberton was in the simulation, they were always being kidnapped, held hostage, or in some danger that would mobilize the Seven into acting. He supposed that's why Alex never took part. He couldn't ever imagine she needed rescuing.
"The captain is very resourceful,"
Quinn remarked as they watched the group following the end of Chris's fist fight with Top Hat Bob.
"He's the best captain in Starfleet,"
Billy said as they both sat on the floor of their bubble, cross-legged and munching on treats as if they were watching a holovid.
"Next to my father, that is."
Billy felt a wave of sadness remembering his father. Although he liked Chris very much, It was not quite the same as the stoic Vulcan, who seemed cold and aloof but could still put him to sleep with a lullaby. Billy missed him very much. Quinn stared at Billy.
You are sad.
Billy tried to hide his pain, but it simply overcame him too quickly.
I do not understand this idea of death. How can one not exist anymore? I have always been.
No, you haven't.
Billy shook his head.
You were born like I was born. Everybody gets born.
But I don't die.
You have to die. Every living thing dies.
I can't die.
His new friend repeated himself.
I don't get sick or hurt and I can't die. My father tells me I will live until the universe stops and beyond it if I want. I could go to the past and live as many times as I like because I won't die.
Billy didn't find that very appealing at all. He might be only a child, but he knew he wouldn't like to live so long that everyone else around him would die first. It had been hard enough losing his father. He would not like to have that experience repeatedly.
That sounds awful.
He says that I should be grateful that I can do anything.
Grown-ups always say that.
Except I can. I made all this happen.
This is a holodeck program.
Yes.
Quinn nodded with an unfathomable expression quite beyond Billy's experience to understand.
Just a program.
You know something?
Buck said to Chris after they put Top Hat Bob some distance behind them. What? Chris dusted himself off as they walked down the street.
If you weren't my captain, I would knock you on your ass.
Buck was unimpressed with the captain's confrontation with Bob in this pseudo-reality where there were no safety protocols to protect them from death, and the characters of the holodeck had somehow gained flesh and blood status.
For once, I'm in complete agreement with Buck.
Alex added.
Captain, that was extremely dangerous. If Bob had played it smart, he could have just shot you when you disarmed yourself to fight him.
Jesus. You two are like a bunch of old women.
Hey!
Mary snapped.
Chris, they're worried about you like I'm worried about you. We're in enough of a mess without you getting yourself killed. The captain is the most important person on the ship. Protocols are in place to safeguard you, not simply because you are the captain but because you are responsible for your crew and your ship.
All right already.
Chris felt a little outnumbered.
I get the point, but might I remind you a starship is not a democracy?
He gave them a hard stare and then noticed that Ezra, the one he expected to be most vocal on this subject, was strangely silent. Normally, the security chief would be the first to point out the risks of facing Bob as he had, but there was a look of disquiet on the commander's face as his eyes studied the surrounding area.
Ezra, what is it?
Josiah asked, noticing it too.
Where is Julia?
Well, she was right behind us when Chris was fighting it out with Bob.
Josiah said when he realized he hadn't seen her since her argument with Ezra.
She'd know better than to just wander off.
Vin pointed out.
Especially now we know this Q is involved.
He might have taken her.
Nathan suggested, aware Q was more than capable of spiriting the people he toyed with away at a moment's notice. He had done the same thing to the Enterprise, transported an entire starship in the blink of an eye to distant space where the Federation engaged the Borg for the very first time. If Q had not set those events into motion, the Federation might have avoided the Borg onslaught for several years. Unfortunately, that premature meeting had altered the course of Alpha Quadrant politics when the major powers realized there were things in space far more terrifying than their rivalries. Chris considered the possibility for the moment and then decided it was unlikely. Since their arrival, one thing was obvious. While Q was content to throw the entire pantheon of Magnificent Seven foes in their direction, he had not engaged them directly. It was the entity's pleasure to watch his players dance to the tune he set for them, not take part in drama himself. If Julia was gone, it was more likely to do with the villains plaguing them since this crazy abduction began.
I don't think so. It isn't his style.
God.
Mary suddenly gasped. Genuine fear filled her eyes.
It could be that disgusting Wicks character. The man's a monster, Chris. If he has Julia.
It will not get that far.
Ezra interjected sharply.
Captain, permission to find Mr. Wicks.
Wait, there's something else.
Nathan hated to consider this as a possibility, but was forced to now they knew they were no longer dealing with holograms but real human beings. The girl he found in the street, no matter how she existed, had been a living person until her brutal murder. To her killer, it didn't matter if Julia was one of them. He would take her life as ruthlessly as he had done to the poor child with the coins in her eyes.
Before we met up with you, we found a body in the street.
A body?
Chris did not at all like the sound of this.
A girl,
Josiah continued.
Young, pretty, and strangled to death. The killer placed coins in her eyes.
That's bizarre. Why?
A cold shudder ran through JD's spine, just picturing the image of a corpse with coins in the eyes.
Well, if it's a classical reference,
Alex spoke up.
It could mean the killer wanted to ensure she had money to pay the ferryman to get to the other side.
Excuse me.
Vin looked at her, puzzled.
In Greek and Roman literature, when you die you have to cross the river Styx to reach the underworld, and Charon the ferryman will take you there only if you pay him. That's why the dead were buried with coins in the eyes.
That is an act of compassion,
Josiah pointed out.
From a man who strangles them beforehand,
Ezra said skeptically, guessing already what Josiah was trying not to come out and say.
Are you telling me a creature like this may have taken Julia?
More than likely, because this doesn't sound like something Wix would do.
Buck hated to admit Nathan could be right because Wix didn't see Julia with him, just Mary and Alex. It made far more sense if the man were going to attack this way, he would have taken one of the two women who had humiliated him earlier. Unfortunately, Julia's abduction seemed more consistent with the behavior of Nathan's murderer.
We are wasting time,
Ezra interrupted, desperate to find Julia. The more and more he heard about this Mr. Wix and this unseen killer stalking women about town and murdering them.
We need to look for her now.
Lieutenant Commander, Chris said sharply, reminding Ezra he was security chief and panic would serve no one. We will find her, but I need your head screwed on right at this moment. Ezra dropped his gaze to the ground for a moment, slightly embarrassed by his lack of professionalism. Julia was the one person in the universe capable of surfacing the real Ezra Standish, not the cold, hard cynic they knew. When he finally met the captain's eyes, Ezra noted the sympathy being exhibited by his friends for his pain and it comforted him.
I apologize.
It's okay, Chris said kindly. But we can't assume anything. If she's with this nut, then we have very little time, so we're going to have to split up. This town isn't that big. We can search for her.
That's right,
Nathan added, not about to assume the worst.
What he does with them needs him placed close to town, so even though time is against us, he won't be far away. If he has her, he'll be wanting to do it someplace quiet where he can enjoy himself, but not be remote enough to have trouble disposing of the body.
Dr. Jackson,
Ezra cleared his throat, wincing each time the doctor used the word body.
Do you think you could sound a little less clinical? I do not see Julia as a body yet.
Yes, please.
Josiah shot Nathan a look because his bedside manner could use a little work.
Sorry.
Nathan winced, mortified by his insensitivity.
However, we also need to keep in mind if he is responsible for Julia's disappearance, he may have bitten off more than he can chew.
I don't follow.
JD responded.
I think I do.
Vin caught on immediately.
This guy is used to dealing with women from this time, who wouldn't know how to put up a fight if he came at them. Julia is not from the 19th century, she's from the 24th and she's an academy-trained Starfleet officer who knows how to get out of trouble if she has to. If this guy has her, Julia may know how to take care of herself, or at the very least, stall him long enough for us to get to him.
Right. Chris gave Vin a smile of gratitude at making that statement because Ezra needed to hear it. At the moment, I'm assuming nothing, so we're splitting up to find her. Ezra, you, Josiah, Alex, and Nathan, see what you can do about finding this killer. I figure the four of you would have a better chance of tracking him than the rest of us.
What are you going to do?
Alex asked. We're going after Mr. Wix. Chances are if you don't find her, we will.
Ezra hoped it was as simple as that. He would rather Julia be in the hands of a whoremaster, even if the entire notion was odious because it would serve the man no purpose to kill her. Nathan's killer, however, would like nothing better than to do just that.
Julia's head hurt. She woke up to a sharp scent in her lungs. The acrid metallic stench assaulted her senses with the efficiency of smelling salts and forced her from the dark place she had been slumbering. Sensation bled into her at a crawl, but when it returned, she almost wished it had not. The dull throbbing that was distant and tolerable soon felt as if a thunderstorm rumbled inside her mind. A groan filled her ears, and it took Julia a few seconds to realize it was hers. Her throat felt parched, and when she lifted her head, fresh pain assailed her once more. She was lying on a wooden floor in a place she couldn't see clearly because her vision was still blurry. Despite her lack of sight, a host of scents assaulted her. What was that pungent aroma that awakened her? Julia forgot the question when she felt the sensation of something warm running across her scalp, dampening her hair. When she felt it on her brow, she knew exactly what it was: blood.
At the attempt to touch her forehead, Julia discovered her arms tied behind her back. The tension of the rope around her wrists brought clarity to her mind with lightning speed. Her eyes flew open, and she immediately struggled, life surging into lethargic limbs. Left too long in their uncomfortable position, the ropes bit into her skin, chafing her flesh as she tried to loosen them enough to free herself. After a few seconds, Julia discovered to her rising panic, the knots ensured she would only tighten them if she continued trying to break free.
You can't escape.
Julia froze. She had been so focused on freeing herself, it never occurred to her she was being watched. Looking up slowly, Julia recognized her surroundings. This was Josiah's church. During her visits to the program, she visited this place several times.
Who are you?
She asked hoarsely, turning towards the man sitting on the nearby pew, watching her closely with dead eyes. Their emptiness sent a chill through Julia's spine.
Nobody.
He continued to observe her like she was the most fascinating thing he had ever seen.
You must be somebody.
Julia tried again.
I have to call you something.
His eyes seemed to gleam.
You can call me, Death.
Chapter 9, Fantasy. When one came down to it, there was no trick to beginning an investigation. No special knack allowing one investigator to succeed where another failed. The misconception popularized by authors such as Arthur Conan Doyle and Agatha Christie would have the everyday man believing one needed to have Holmes's dispassionate demeanor or Poirot's incredible arrogance to see clues where none existed. In fiction, pure deductive reasoning was all one needed to see through the chaotic disarray of a crime scene and visualize the violence that may or may not have occurred there. There was one place to launch the search for Julia Pemberton, where she was last seen. Although Ezra was mindful that Top Hat Bob and his men might still be in the area, the security chief of the USS Maverick had little choice in the matter. Fortunately, by the time the quartet of Starfleet officers returned to the narrow alleyway where Julia disappeared, there was no sign of the villains. Ezra assumed Bob was probably somewhere licking his wounds.
She stood right here,
Josiah explained, standing in the narrow space between the two buildings.
Then you two got into that argument, and she wandered off.
It was not an argument.
Ezra bit back as he moved down the corridor.
It was a difference of opinion.
Whatever.
Alex brushed past the comment. Ezra was one of her closest friends on the Maverick. Although she suspected he was less jaded than he liked everyone to believe, they shared the same wry sense of humor and were natural cynics.
I wish Wynn had come with us. He's pretty good at spotting tracks on the ground. Something about growing up in the wilderness, I suppose.
We do not require Mr. Tanner's expertise this time around,
Ezra said tautly as he saw the marks in the dirt and quickly deciphered them.
She went down this path. I can see the grooves of her heel in the dirt.
Really?
Nathan exclaimed impressed, seeing nothing but unevenness in some places than others.
How can you tell?
The women of this time wore shoes with different heels from men. Male footwear came with broader heels. Ladies' footwear possessed heels that tapered in that area.
Ezra gestured to the tracks they had all examined after he had made his statement.
You can see how it digs into the earth first, pushing dirt around it before being flattened out by the rest of the shoe.
I'll be damned,
Josiah remarked, impressed.
I see what you mean. She came this way then,
Alex said unhappily, feeling very anxious about Julia's situation. She almost wished Mr. Wicks had the chief engineer in his hands. At least, they had assurance Julia might survive the next few hours since Wicks would need her alive to replace one of the working girls he supposedly lost because of Buck Wilmington. Anything had to be better than being in the hands of a serial killer. Although societal upheavals and advancements in criminology had more or less prevented the criminal psychopathy from wreaking havoc unchecked, occasional specimens sometimes slipped through the cracks of modern vigilance. In the 20th century, they had been as virulent as any disease and no less easy to cure. The serial killer was a random animal, following a pattern usually unique only to him. Behavioral science could make predictions, but every new subject added another variable to the accumulated data. Catching a serial killer required determining the pattern of their violence, and it was almost unheard of to do so within 24 hours of the first crime. The subject they now faced had been killing for quite some time, even though Alex did not want to say it, mainly because Ezra would know it himself. The chances of catching this creature in time to save Julia were slim. When they reached the same back door Julia discovered earlier, Ezra froze. His heart pounded louder in his chest, even though he was trying his best not to panic. Razor-sharp intellect scoured the grimy brick walls, examining the faded paint on the wooden doorway. He noted the greasy handprints on the doorknob and knew even if he could lift prints off the handle, it would be of little good to them. Fingerprint evidence was only valuable if the murderer had a prior record. In this period, fingerprinting was akin to suggesting a man could reach the moon and was more or less a redundant exercise.
The tracks stop,
Alex noted. Seeing the disappearance of Julia's footprints, now she knew what to look for. Whatever manner Julia left this alley, she had not done so on foot.
Yes, they have.
Josiah noticed the ashen expression on the security officer's face as Ezra stared at the opposite wall. When Josiah followed his gaze, he could understand why Ezra was so horrified. Josiah swallowed and found his voice after a few seconds.
Is that what I think it is?
Alex recovered far more quickly and was barking at Nathan to come forward.
Doctor.
Nathan approached and looked. He gave Ezra a sympathetic glance as he ran his finger along the brick. What came off it clung to his fingertips, and Nathan identified the substance immediately.
It's blood.
Ezra.
Alex said quickly.
This proves nothing. She probably fought him, and one of them got hurt.
Yes, there is always that possibility.
However, his voice did not sound as if he entirely believed it.
Maybe he knocked her out. There's not a lot of blood, so this could be a minor injury.
It must be.
Ezra insisted and looked past the doorway.
I do not see further evidence of bleeding. Of course, if we had our tricorders, this might be so much simpler.
All right.
Alex took the initiative, empathizing with the emotional turbulence Ezra was enduring at this moment.
He knocked her out here and carried her wherever he was going. Now he can't have gone very far without attracting attention. This is not the place where a person with Julia's standing in the community could be slung over someone's shoulder without being seen. He must have entered the hotel through this door. I can't see him trying for the street.
I can.
Ezra countered. Her theory prompted his own thought processes into motion.
Do not forget, at the time of her abduction, we were engaged in a rather nasty firefight with Mr. Top Hat Bob and his cohorts. No one would have cared about seeing a man carrying a woman away, not when they were all hiding within their enclaves for fear of being struck by random fire.
Damn.
Josiah swore because Ezra was right.
So they could be anywhere.
Nathan groaned, with more than a trace of defeat in his voice.
More or less.
Alex nodded. Ezra did not speak as he followed the footprints leading out of the doorway. Even though there was no blood, there were still tracks. Julia's wound was superficial, or else the bleeding would be worse. The deeper indentations left behind showed the man was carrying her. She was likely rendered unconscious in this tiny little annex, evidenced by blood on the wall. A cold sliver of ice burrowed into his heart, and no matter what he told himself, Ezra knew it would not go away until he found Julia.
We will begin searching,
Ezra stated, snapping out of his dark thoughts regarding his lover's fate. He had to believe she was alive, or he would be no good to her.
We can safely ignore the saloons or the hotel.
Yes. He'll need privacy to do what he has to. I'd say the livery stable or a cellar, somewhere.
He couldn't just break into someone's house,
Nathan pointed out.
That would draw attention.
That's right.
The counselor agreed, well aware of some of the universal characteristics of the psychosis he was dealing with.
This is a man who feels inferior. He conjures up fantasies involving himself and the women who are his victims. In his world, they are playing a part, and it is a private world where only the two of them exist. Inviting others would destroy the fantasy, and he can't have that. It would take the satisfaction out of the killing.
God,
Alex whispered under her breath.
Ezra.
The counselor turned to the security chief.
Would it help if we went and found Mr. Poplar?
The Pinkerton detective.
Alex remembered the man Josiah had mentioned.
Yes. Perhaps he may have some idea how to help us with Julia. I don't like him much, and he's a cretin, but I get the impression he's been on the killer's trail for some time and may give us a little help.
Ezra considered the notion.
I am open to any help we might get. Go find him. Alex and I will continue our search. We'll meet back at this location in 20 minutes.
So soon?
Nathan looked at him. Although Four Corners was not a large town, it was not a small one either, and searching for Poplar may take longer than that time.
Yes.
Ezra nodded, brooking no argument on this point. He was unhappy with their lack of progress and knew Julia could not afford to wait until they eventually found her. Time was running out. He could feel its diminishing quantity pressing up against his spine. Even he showed nothing of it to his friends. The fear he felt was so palpable it might reach up and choke him.
A great deal can take place in 20 minutes, Dr. Jackson. A great deal.
Death. The word hung from his lips, and Julia wondered if he was just sadistic or insane.
It did not take her very long to discover he was both. He sat at the pew watching her, allowing minutes to pass without speaking, aware the silence would heighten her terror as much as the length of cord in his hands. His fingers gently caressed the rough hessian fibers like something to be savored.
"What do you want?"
she asked, unable to bear it. He was staring at her like a statue, watching her. His eyes were almost black, and Julia suspected he was building up to something that would have fatal consequences for her. Once again, he continued to stare in silence. Julia decided she would not wait for him to do his worst.
"Somebody help me!"
Her scream was short because he was out of the pew immediately, making long strides towards her. Julia braced herself and watched him come closer. She was only going to have one chance to escape, but she would try because the look in his eyes told her she had no other choice. He was allowing his fantasy to gain momentum, building it into a swell of rage that would explode in a violent outburst. Julia was smart enough to know she would not survive the outpouring of dark and twisted emotion. The distance between them disappeared. Before Julia knew it, his shadow fell over her, almost as if the Reaper had stepped into her presence. Julia's heart raced inside her breast as she watched the insistent caress of the rope in his hands become more and more urgent. The beast inside him was awake. Once roused, it would not be restrained until it fed. When he was close enough, she kicked out her foot suddenly. The heel connected with his ankle, and he yelled out in pain. Instinctively, he raised his injured foot, and when he did so, Julia kicked out again, ensuring her heel landed just above his knee. Her kick was solid and desperate, with more than enough force to sweep his legs from under him. Julia did not wait to see him fall. She rolled onto her knees and pushed herself up as best she could. However, her progress was slow, and even though she heard him fall to the floor, scuffling sounds told her he was recovering quickly and would be after her in seconds.
"Help me!"
Julia screamed again, hoping someone, anyone, would hear her.
"Shut up!"
She heard him shout behind her and knew from his voice he was not far away. She scrambled to her feet, preparing to run, but her clothes and bound hands hampered her movements, stealing critical seconds she could not afford to waste. His hand fisted around her ankle and yanked back sharply. Julia could not prevent herself from stumbling and slammed chin first into the floorboards without her hands to break her fall. The impact almost knocked her out, and as the pain emanated from her jaw and shuddered throughout her body, she felt blood filling her mouth.
"Bitch!"
She heard him scream through the haze of disorientation but could not do much else. Julia did not see his fists flying as he straddled her. The room was still spinning when his knuckle met her jaw. She was aware of crying as the blows dislodged teeth and felt flesh swelling in her bruised face as he continued to pummel her, unaware of what he was doing. Her audacity to fight back inspired a mountain of rage. She dared to destroy the fantasy he prepared for them both, and she would pay dearly for that. Her cries soon disintegrated into whimpers of agony. She did not know how much damage he caused, only aware she could no longer see. The smell of blood filled her lungs with such entirety that it nauseated her to the brink of retching. Where was Ezra? Julia wondered, anguished as she felt another bone shatter and was sure it was her cheekbone finally giving in. Why wasn't he here? She wailed inside her mind, inside her pain, for him to come and save her from this nightmare. Yet there was no reason for him to come, even if he knew about her plight. After all, she had not treated him fairly. How could Julia blame Ezra for what he had done just because he loved her? How could he have known it wasn't her? Strange how simple things became when poised between life and death. Julia thought about her ship and her friends. She thought about Ezra because she was too weak and in too much pain to do much else. It was becoming hard to breathe, and she wondered if the crushing pressure around her throat had something to do with it. There was no way for Julia to tell what was happening even though she could hear his movements, slow and deliberating sounds echoing sinister intent with every ounce of pain she suffered. The beating left her eyes swollen, and the only thing she could feel was fresh, warm blood gurgling from her mouth and down a corner of her lips. She could no longer scream, but she could make words, even if no one could hear them.
"Ezra."
The constriction around her throat paused for a moment.
"Ezra."
Julia tried again, wishing to hear Ezra's name spoken because hearing it could give her strength to last a little longer. Or, at the very least, say what she needed to before it was too late. Of course, it would mean little to anyone but Julia since Ezra was not here to hear it.
"I'm sorry."
She whispered and knew the warmth running out of her eyes was not blood but tears. It was becoming harder and harder to breathe, and the pressure around her throat was so intense she could not inhale to take air into her lungs. Her mind fogged over as she began her descent into the gray numbness of brain asphyxia. She choked, and her heaving grew more frantic and desperate until finally, she could take in nothing at all. Her breaths became ragged gasps. For a time, she could not focus on Ezra in her head as she battled for the last minutes of light left in her. However, when she finally succumbed, when her body and spirit accepted the dark rushing at her, she thought of Ezra again, until she could think no more. The minute he saw the crowd gathered in the middle of the street, Ezra Standish knew. He was a man who relied almost entirely on the sixth sense that made him the security chief he was and an unbeatable card sharp at the poker table. When he felt that hollow feeling of dread rising inside him, Ezra knew why. Alex broke into a run, leaving him behind to investigate what was drawing the townsfolk's attention. Ezra could not bring his legs to move any faster because he was sure of what was waiting for him. While those around him saw the gambler of the Magnificent Seven striding forward confidently to the scene of the commotion, inside, he was quivering with fear. Ezra saw Alex breaking through the crowd only to freeze a split second later at what she saw there. For a moment, she remained still before her shoulders sagged as she disappeared from view for a few seconds as she became lost in the small gathering. Ezra continued to walk, compelled to move even though he had no wish to. Then he saw Alex reappear. She pushed her way past the townspeople. Tears filled her brown eyes as she bit her lip, trying to stop herself from crying.
Ezra, stay where you are.
She spoke with all the authority of her rank but knew it would do little good.
You don't want to see this.
Ezra brushed past her. Alex caught his arm to keep him from taking another step.
Please.
She implored, and this time the tears came.
You don't want to see this.
I have to.
No, you don't.
Ezra ignored her and forced his way through. The townspeople, aware of the relationship between the gambler and the Emporium owner, stepped aside immediately. Only Josiah and Nathan remained. The duo was searching for Poplar, and their lack of success brought them into the streets, where they noticed the crowd forming and realized they were too late. Nathan was leaning over the body, and Josiah looked up to see Ezra breaking the circle of spectators.
Ezra,
Josiah said softly.
I am so sorry.
Ezra blinked as he looked down and saw Nathan removing his hand from her neck, where he had been attempting to locate a pulse. Judging by the somber expression on his face, Ezra guessed there was none to find. Ezra's breath caught in his throat as he saw those lovely features battered so severely that it was impossible to see the beautiful woman he loved, the Titian goddess with her emerald-colored eyes. Eyes he could not see because they were swollen shut and concealed by the two silver dollars.
Why did he do this? Why did he hurt her so badly?
Because,
Ezra said, his voice shaking as he forced the words out.
She fought him. She would not have allowed him to kill her without a fight, and because she fought him, he had to subdue her. He had to break every bone in her face to do that.
Ezra,
Josiah started to say, but the security chief was not listening. Instead, Ezra dropped to his knees gently next to her and ran his fingers over the soft strands of copper-colored hair he so loved to feel against his skin when she kissed him. He ran his hand against her cheek, ignoring the blood caked over her skin. Now that she was gone, Ezra doubted he would care about anything again. Ezra lowered his lips to her ear, and though Julia could not hear him, Ezra had to say goodbye, or he would not have the courage to hunt down the bastard who did this to her.
I love you, Julia. I always will. I promise you, I will find him, and I will kill him.